fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KTLA 106.5 FM, Los Angeles,
102.3 FM, Riverside,
and 105.0 AM, Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Now, today, interviewing, I'm quizzing the man himself, who's normally on Tuesdays, but this time he's got a new book that's come out called Dr. Francis Tumblety and the Railway Ripper. So, Mr. Michael Al Hawley.
Hello, Al. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing okay. You've got this new book out, and of course, you're kind of centering it around, you call the Railway Ripper.
Yes. Yes.
But he is a suspect in the Jack the Ripper murders as well.
Correct.
For you, for sure. Now, let's talk about this. First of all, why did you go back into Tumblety, and what more were you looking for?
Well, one of the questions, one of the first couple chapters I use is actually just to get the reader to know how he's connected to the Whitechapel murders when he was arrested on suspicion, and then, of course, when they nobody saw the murder, so they couldn't arrest him or charge him for the murder, so they arrested him on a misdemeanor case, and he posted bail, and he sneaked out of the country, and the murder stopped. So when he came back to America, they followed him, and they did an investigation while he was in America. Well, the issue was that really true? Because a lot of the experts were trying to think maybe it was a little bit fake news. So I really basically put that to bed. As in, my first two chapters show that not only did they follow him, they continued an investigation, which meant that he was one of the top suspects, if not the prime suspect at the peak of the murders. Well, then a question that I always get when I would be doing my lectures is, if he truly was a serial killer, did he, when he came back to America, were there any murders? And so what I did was, is I decided to search. And so what happened is, as I was searching, not only did I find murders, I found actually 39 unsolved murders where I cannot eliminate Tumblety as being the suspect. I had set it up to be pretty easy because here's Tumblety. He was actually what they used to call a hermaphrodite. He basically had no functioning penis. And so what happened was, is most women, young women, sadly, who were murdered on the streets, and it did not have to be streetwalkers, sex workers, but it's just on the streets, they were first raped, then murdered. So they called it outrage at the time. And I saw that quite a bit. But what I discovered was that around 1880, I started seeing these, what they called mysterious murders in America, that the woman was neither raped nor robbed. So at that time, there was no FBI, but it was just the local detectives, and they called it motiveless murders because of those usual motives. And so they really didn't know about serial killers at the time. So it wasn't only just 39 unsolved murders. There were 39 attempted murders or assaults that I found that, again, I cannot eliminate Tumblety because of where Tumblety was. The nice thing about the unsolved, the assaults, is they're generally an eyewitness description. And so Tumblety was unusually tall at the time. He was 6 feet tall. When he came back to America, when he sneaked out of London, it was reported that he was wearing an Ulster coat. And time again, I get this tall man in a gray Ulster coat with a thick mustache. And so that's kind of what happened. And then the details of it are even more surprising.
Before we get into this, the details and all this stuff like this, for the people that don't know who he is, who was Dr. Francis Tumblety? As in, you know, where was he basically born? He grew up, and what did he do as a job? Was he a real doctor? Kind of go through a basic description of his life besides the murders.
Okay, he was a quack doctor. So he was born actually in County Meath, Ireland, and I discovered that. In 1830, and by 1847, he and part of his family came to America on a famine ship. So it was during the potato famine, especially the year 1847, where the spring and the fall crops, potato crops, went under. So that ship, they came over, and at the time, the northeast of the United States was experiencing a boon in the economy thanks to the Erie Canal, which is pretty much centered in Rochester, New York. And some of Tumblety's family members were already in Rochester. He was one of 11. So when he came to America, he was around 17 years old, plus or minus there. But when he came to America, that within 9 years, he became actually an Indian herb doctor. In Rochester, he got caught up with a couple quack doctors, one an Indian herb doctor. And by 1856, Tumblety was on his own. He crossed the border into what they called Canada West at the time, but it was Ontario. And incidentally, it was London, Ontario, where he started. Within 3 years, he became a millionaire. He was so good at exploiting. And that's what I found out, was how he exploited these people. He was really good, as in what he would do is someone would come into his office. First, he would advertise like crazy, saying that he could cure everything, cure cancer, cure tuberculosis, cure everything. So when they'd come in, here's an example. One young man said, came in because he had acne and he wanted that cured. So when he came in the door, Tumblety would say, "Oh my gosh, you're a goner. You have tuberculosis. Good news for you. I have these pills, and then within 2 weeks, you're going to be cured. Come back in 2 weeks." And it was an exorbitant amount of money. Came back, and he was cured. And he convinced these people so much that he had testimonial after testimonial in the newspapers. But it was a scam, and that's what I found in some court records in Toronto. But within 3 years, he became a millionaire by doing that. But at the same time, he was getting himself into trouble because he was molesting young boys all through his life. And then he was the treatment towards women was poor right at the very beginning. Even the mayor of London, Ontario, fined him some money because of his poor treatment of one of his female customers. So that was 1856, and then it came from, continued. But so he went through Canada, and he would get himself into trouble, continue, but he would still make a lot of money as this quack doctor. What happened was, when he got to St. John, one of his patients, customers, actually died. And so they had a coroner's inquest, and what happened is, at that inquest, they had to do an autopsy on the guy to see if it was his drugs that killed him. And Tumblety actually tried to steal the man's organs at the examination room the night of the inquest. So through Canada, he had this passion for organs. When he was going to be charged with manslaughter, or the coroner's inquest recommended that, he sneaked out of the country, came back to America, and that's when the Civil War began. And at the beginning of the Civil War, he came to Washington, D.C. to claim he was a surgeon. He was claiming that he was going to be a surgeon for General McClellan. But he had no medical diploma. He had a fake one, but his idea was, if he could have the Army consider him a surgeon, that was his credentials. And so he did this in the evening. He invited all the officers, the eyes and ears of General McClellan, to come, and he did a illustrated medical lecture, and he showed all of his organs, all the organs that he had collected, especially his uterus collection. This eyewitness said that his favorite part of his collection was the uterus. And of course, Jack the Ripper took the uterus out of two women. And it begins from there. But then he continued to get himself in trouble. But by 1873, he started visiting London or England each year until 1888, of the murders. And so that's why he admitted himself that he was at the Whitechapel district when the murders occurred.
So what was his hatred toward females and women? Was there a particular reason? Was it his mother? Was it his sister? Like, where do you think that comes from?
Well, now he claimed it was with that one eyewitness that it was because his wife, he found out his wife was a prostitute, but I found out that that was actually fake. He was, that was his front to tell why he was not married or anything. And what happened is under sworn testimony, his nephew, only 5 years his junior, said that Tumbledy was never married. He always had a passion for young men. But what happened was, is in his writings, what came out was he was very religious, and he was Catholic. And back then, many Catholics, this is not doctrine, but many Catholics believed that it was not Adam that committed the original sin. It was Eve deceiving Adam. Therefore, women were the curse of the land, and disease came from the original sin. So the disease, including his condition as intersex condition, having both male and female parts, that he would believe that it was women that did that. So he hated women from the outset. And you could see it was in the family because there's a report that one of his brothers had the same hatred of women. And then when you look at the census material, the three brothers were considered literate, but all the sisters were considered illiterate. So even the family members, only the boys could go to school. So, but what happened was, is that then I found out that by 1880, he found out he had syphilis. He was hypersexual, so he was the perfect target group to catch syphilis. And so he caught syphilis, and of course he blamed these women. And then I found out by the year the Ripper murders were 1888, by around 1886, he started hanging out with a neurosurgeon who was an expert at paresis, or paralysis of the insane, which we now call neurosyphilis, which is a tertiary stage of syphilis. Tumbledy, he was a narcissist, so he had 6 autobiographies. In the autobiographies, he talked about this. So he was basically admitting that he actually contracted neurosyphilis a couple years before the murder, so his mind was kind of going. So what I was looking for if Tumbledy was indeed a serial killer, and if he came back to America and was murdering women, what was that trigger point? We know serial offenders, there's a trigger point. Even though they may have lacked remorse all their life, but something happened where they began to kill. And then they realized that they actually liked this. And so in the 1870s, I find very few of these mysterious murders. But 1880, I find it began. And the coolest thing was, here's Tumbledy, a quack doctor. He considered his home as New York City. And he had actually got himself in trouble because someone had come to him for an abortion when he was in Canada. But what happened was, is in 1881, this Ella Clark came from Connecticut back to the Manhattan to get an abortion. So she went to this quack doctor, a different quack doctor, to ask for this abortion. And she wanted it private, so she stayed with a friend. She was a young lady. And so then the young lady said the next day, Ella Clark said, I'm going back to to get my abortion. Well, she never came back, and they found her body. She was dismembered across the river in Long Island, but her head was with her. I mean, all their parts except her organs. The police, because her head was there, they could identify her, and they realized that talking to the friend, they realized that she went to this quack doctor that was on Manhattan. Well, he had a solid alibi. He wasn't even in town. Well, surprise, surprise, just a few months before that, we know that Tumbledy had his quack doctor office just a few blocks south. His office is actually closer to that friend's apartment or residence than the other quack doctor. And so here it is, this woman was searching for a quack doctor, and next thing you know, she's missing. Not only missing, her organs are missing, but she was dismembered. How coincidental that we have this quack doctor, Francis Tumbledy, in the same area. What the police thought was that they thought it was a quack doctor that killed her, but they thought it was she went there for, an abortion, that it was an abortion gone awry, so the quack doctor freaked out, so tried to hide the body. But if you did that, not that I'm a serial killer or anything, or someone that kills, but you don't leave the head with the body. The head is the only thing at the time to identify the woman. So if it was just a quack doctor mistaken abortion, then you would have put the head somewhere else. Her body was next to the railroad tracks. And this is the other thing that I'd seen was starting in 1880, these women were found in a very similar, very Ripper-like murders near railroad tracks and railroad stations. And it continues till about 1900, very surprising ones. But so again, if you think about it, if there was no FBI at the time, so if a murder occurred, if a serial killer was on the train tracks, got off the train station, murdered a woman, got back on the train and left, they would have never caught him because those locals were thinking that it was probably a farmhand that was the killer or an ex-boyfriend. And then this person's long gone. And so not only would they be long gone, kind of like the Golden State Killer, that it would have been decades long while this person was doing it. And that's what I had found in the 1880s to the 1890s, through the 1890s, this pattern, one of the patterns. So that's why my book is called Dr. Francis Tumbling a Railway Ripper, because I'm convinced that I've found a 19th century serial killer that was taking advantage of the railways. Incidentally, I found a top Jack the Ripper suspect that I can't eliminate from each and every one of those.
What was his MO in this particular case, with these railway Ripper murders? What was his goal with each of these, do you think?
I think it's if you look at the Whitechapel murders, and that's one place where we could find this, that the first of the victims, you could see that they were choked to guess the first. Strangled. So it could have been Jack the Strangler, actually. And so what happened was Dr. Brent Turvey, when he looked at the Whitechapel victims or the records, he did not see the normal sadosexual serial killer, as in, let's say, a John Wayne Gacy, where he is sadistically kind of killing, reviving, these young men before he kills them, and it's part of the sexual attraction. This would be a different case, and he did not see the sadosexual in the Whitechapel murders. What he saw was anger, retaliatory rage. So you saw, let's say, attack the face with Catherine Eddowes, attack the face, and then also a reassurance oriented, so where there's display going on. And then, so that's what he saw. And so Tumbledy, because he preferred young men, if Jack the Ripper was a sadosexual serial killer, Tumbly would not be your man because he would have gone after young men. But again, because Dr. Brent Turvey sees this and Dr. William Eckert had shown that there was no sadistic behavior whatsoever, these women were murdered or mutilated post-mortem. This would fit Tumbly to a T, this rage, this anger that he caught syphilis from and I have sworn testimony of a number of people that knew Tumbly in the last 20 years of his life that he had a bitter hatred of widow or maid, not all women, but widow or maid, or women that would lure young men away from, or decoy, as they said, decoy young men from their intended lover, him. Not even other men, but him. So you can see that kind of pattern with the Whitechapel murders. And so that more again would fit Tumbledy. So what I was looking in America was not necessarily an identical MO, because we don't have an identical MO with the Whitechapel murders. They have what we call five of the women in Whitechapel that were murdered. They call them the canonical five because they all had their throats cut. Four of the five had their throats cut deeply right to the spine, and then three of them had mutilation. One did not have any mutilation, but you could see it was a surprise attack. So you could see similar patterns, but there were still upwards of 11 sex workers that were murdered. And so some experts think that there's more than just the five. The previous one, Martha Tabram, you could see that she was just stabbed 39 times and then murdered. And so it just depends on how you're looking at it. But if you're looking at this, I was looking for Ripper-like murders where I started with sex workers, where a sex worker was murdered with her throat cut. And nobody knew this. Oh, by the way, all 76 of these murders and assaults, you can't find online. Every one are, I found on, let's say, newspapers.com, and all of these unsolved murders and attacks, at least I'm giving these women a voice now, but it's really surprising that nobody had ever seen anything like this. But what happened was, is August 1888 were the first of the Whitechapel murders, if you consider the canonical five. Well, Tumbledee, he was in New York City up until May of 1888. And we know that because of some reports. The last time Tumbledee was seen was May 1888. We know that he was in London by July 1888 because that was the four young men that he had molested. They had that date on an indictment. So between May and June, that's when Tumbledee had left New York City for London. And then the Whitechapel murders occurred. Unsurprisingly, May of 1888 in New York City, within blocks of where Tumbledee would be, actually at the Bowery District, where a lot of the Bowery prostitutes were, a Bowery prostitute was murdered Ripper style, her throat cut to the spine in what they call Little Italy now. And so she was murdered in the basement, in the cellar, they called it. And they call it the rag picker's cellar because they had a rag picker that would work there. And the rag pickers at the time would rent their spaces out in the cellar to sex workers to do their business and even for some people to sleep the night. And this woman that lived in that lodging house swore that she saw that rag picker with the woman that was murdered, this Miskowitz. So she was convinced that rag picker had a solid alibi. He wasn't even around. So she saw this man with the woman after midnight. And so the woman was, the prostitute was found murdered in the morning. So they gave a physical description of this rag picker. 6 foot tall, dark mustache. That's exactly Francis Tumbledee. How interesting that there's a Ripper-like murder and one of the prime Ripper suspects is in the area within blocks before he left. And then it just begins after that. So I found that, and I was kind of surprised that nobody else had found this murder and then even connected it. When Tumbledee came back December 2nd, there were two New York City police officers or detectives waiting for him that knew him by sight, but there was a Scotland Yard detective waiting for him too. So then Tumbledee sneaked off to his old haunt where the lodging house at 79 East 10th Street, which is that, by the way, 77 East 10th Street is where he had his office for his Indian herb doctor business in 1881. But in 1888, he was staying at that lodging house. Well, what happened was is there were two reporters, New York City reporters from the New York Herald and also the New York World that spotted this Scotland Yard detective outside the window. He was at the bar that was outside the window of Tumbledee's space. So they tried to interview this Scotland Yard detective and he refused to. So they actually interviewed the bartenders because the Scotland Yard detective was talking to the bartenders drinking. And so the bartender said, yeah, this guy said he came over to America to get the guy that did it, the Whitechapel murders. And he's looking up at Tumbledee's window. So what happened was that was December 3rd. By the December 4th papers, that was in the paper. Well, Tumbledee vanished December 5th. And nobody knew where he went until a couple years ago. I found out where he went. He went to Waterloo, New York. And I knew that because local papers have been digitizing their newspapers, that this local Waterloo paper had digitized it. It was a newspapers.com. And I knew that what happened was a reporter said that Tumbledee's in town. And so I knew that was right because his sister lived there. And in 1881, right, same year, Tumbledee was actually in Toronto. He got arrested for sodomy with a young man. And so he sneaked off to his sister's in Waterloo. And how we know that is because his nephew, Thomas Powderly, lived in Waterloo and remembered that event. So he would sneak off to Waterloo. So when he was in Waterloo, the reporter reported that because what happened was a woman was accosted that night, which is a strange thing for a little Waterloo, New York. But a woman was attacked by the throat, but she got away and ran away. The reporter was the one that believed that it was Tumbledee. Well, Tumbledee vanished. And then what happened was a week later in Chicago, this young lady was in downtown Chicago, and she was riding the cable cars or the trains, And she remembered a tall man in a thick mustache with an ulster coat sitting across from her. So she got out. It was nighttime, and she was walking the tracks to go to the next spot, and he attacked her by the throat, dropped her onto the ground, and said, you know, and then she screamed and fought and got away, and she saw these train track workers, so she ran towards them, and the man tried to shoot at her. And that, and I knew that there were a couple of times where Tumbly was arrested for carrying a revolver in America, in the United States. So, and she said there was a tall man with a thick mustache. That's, that was December 1888. And then I get a newspaper article saying, Tumbly's supposed to be in Chicago. I wasn't looking for that thing. So here it is. So then 1886, this is one of my chapters is called The Bookends to the Whitechapel Murders, because just before, just after the Whitechapel murders, we have these similar murders with this tall man in a gray ulster coat. In Buffalo, New York, where I'm from, there was a case of three young ladies that were assaulted on the streets downtown Buffalo next to the train station, where this tall man in a gray ulster coat attacked them, grabbed them by the throat first, and the woman started struggling to get away. He pulls out a revolver and says, I'll shoot you if you don't stop moving. And then some guy in the back said, hey, and then the guy ran away. And so you can see this pattern of a tall man in a gray ulster coat, and I keep on finding this tall man in a gray ulster coat, and then sometimes a tall man in a gray ulster coat with a thick mustache throughout the 1880s and 1890s. It just keeps on going in this rash of these attacks. There was this tall man in a gray ulster coat. It was late in the 1890s. That what happened was, it was Connecticut, and it was Danbury, Connecticut, but this young lady named Ollie Richmond, so she was walking the streets in this, now this is 1899, so Tumbly would have been an older man by this time. And what happened was, an old man, and a tall man in an ulster coat, I can't believe that, came up, sprayed this stuff in her eyes, and he ran away. And so what happened was, that was a combination of cayenne pepper and metal shavings. So she was so then just before that, actually in 1892, in New York City, just a block away from where Tumbly lived, in Washington Square, this during the daytime this time, there was this tall man that would wear diamonds and walk with an umbrella. And we know Tumbly always walked with an umbrella. We had a couple cases of that. And he used to wear a diamond pin. And so he always kept diamonds. He had a few thousand dollars of cash in one pocket, jewelry in the other pocket. So if he ever got caught in the slums, because that's what everybody said, he used to hang out in the slums at night. And if he was arrested, he could see, show everybody that he was a man of higher status. But this time it was during the day. And so what he would do is, he would walk by, and when a woman would walk by, he would trip the woman, and the woman would fall on her face, and then he would run away. And so they did it so often that the police were informed, and they jokingly, because it was just 2 years after the murders, they called him Jack the Tripper. It screams of Tumbly. And one of the things we know about serial killers like the Golden State Killer and even BTK Killer, they'll stop, and they have this cooling off period. What they do is they're trying to stop the killings for a while for any reason. Maybe they got married, or the police are close to them. And so they call the activities they do to try to kind of substitute for murdering, they call it non-homicidal fantasy activities. So the BTK killer would kind of take pictures of himself all bound up and things, weird things like this. So this kind of matches where Tumbly maybe was not trying to kill, but he was still trying to embarrass, abuse, and women. So. But that was a few things, and a lot of things happened throughout that time. Lots of interesting things.
You said that he had a penis that didn't work.
Right.
So how was he sexually assaulting boys or even girls, women, and what was he doing with them? Like, how does that work? And how would you get syphilis?
So these are excellent questions, actually, because of that sadosexual serial killer thing. So one thing is he never Jack the Ripper did not sexually assault those sex workers. That's one thing that people don't understand, is that even though they were sex workers, they were not mutilated. Although there's one that had a couple stab wounds next to the vagina. But what happens is what Tumbly would do was, we have a sworn testimony of a young man. His name was Richard Norris. And in 1881, Richard Norris said that Tumblety, because he was flashing all this money, and he asked young Richard Norris if he could write some letters for him. And Richard Norris knew, he said, Richard Norris, although during the 1905 court case that he was in, when he was talking under sworn testimony, he said that when he was younger, he admitted that he would make extra money being a male prostitute. So this was New Orleans. And we never knew that Tumblety was going to New Orleans, but we found out that from 1881 to 1901, Tumblety, every year during the Mardi Gras season, we would go to New Orleans and visit this Richard Norris. But Richard Norris eventually had kids, and he was working for the New Orleans Police Department at the time he was doing this. So it was illegal what he was doing, but he was still admitting. In 1881, what he did was, is Tumblety showed him his travel chest, and inside his travel chest were these surgical knives. And these were the this was a travel chest that he would take with him to even London. So here is, we have a Jack the Ripper suspect carrying surgical knives with him in the 1880s. And so what Richard Norris remembered what he did was, one time, he first befriended him for a few weeks, but then Francis Tumblety took that one of those knives and put it to Norris's throat and sexually molested, actually just kind of sodomized him. And so, and here's Richard Norris saying, you know, I am a male, you know, a sex worker, so he could have just paid me, but he wanted to force it on him. And so then he got angry and started fighting with Tumblety, but then Tumblety, you know, calmed down, he apologized and gave him a whole bunch of money. And so what he would do is he would ask, he said that he would ask to be penetrated by the young man. So that's, he would act, and he said it felt like a woman to him. This is under sworn testimony. So that's what he would do is, the, one of the, where the lodging house he was at, the woman that ran this said that Tumblety had a line of young men every night coming into his room. He had three rooms. He'd always rent out three rooms. So, but so Richard Norris had said that that's what he did. He would, that's how he kind of did it. So what I did was, is how did he contract the syphilis? It would have been these male prostitutes. And what I found out is when there was a, even especially back then, when there was a rash of syphilis because of sex workers, it was both male and female because there was interchanging all the time. Even every one of his young men, even Henry Hall Caine, they actually got married, so they were bisexual, even though Tumblety was not. So, though the sex workers admitted that they would be going both ways. So you could see that regardless of if who he had sex with, that's how he caught his syphilis, by a young man. But he blamed women for that because they were the curse of the land.
Well, they were the dirty ones.
That's correct. Just ask him. And I actually have letters, Neil Story, and you know we're going to interview Neil Story next week, but he actually discovered these letters that it's Francis Tumblety talking about these this case, these things, about his letters. He wrote about him and being so, I would say, he had a complete hatred for that, a young woman.
Did the police ever suspect him of anything or arrest him or take him in for any assaults or murders or rape or any of those sort of charges?
So here's the issue is that we, you know, one of the things about serial killers, let's say, for example, I like the Golden State Killer again. No one knew. It wasn't until DNA that who he was. No one knew who he was. And so like that Joseph DeAngelo, and he was a police officer. So there was no history of that. So he would have been buried this to his grave. And so we, even the, some of the, I mean, for decades, we knew of, you know, these long haul serial, trucker serial killers. No one knew about it. And until, again, DNA happened. So Tumblety, to me, he would have been one of those. But we do know certain times that the police knew more than they were saying. Because, for example, his Baltimore attorney was, he was in that same court case. So under sworn testimony, he told the judge and the attorney that are asking him questions that how he knew that Tumblety was, had an intersex condition or a hermaphrodite because Tumblety passed out in his office. And what he said was, all the police knew it. The police knew what he was doing. they all knew that he was, again, they used to call it hermaphrodite. We don't have any, today we don't have any record of the police knowing about that. So we can see that the police knew what Tumbly was doing, like in that case, but we don't have any record. All we have is now is a sworn testimony by this attorney talking about the police. What happened, though, is when Tumbly was arrested on suspicion, they interviewed the San Francisco chief of police, Tumbly was an herb doctor for a while there, and they asked, did you know this Francis Tumbly, who is still incarcerated in London? And he says, yeah, but he was just a quack doctor. But then the next day, he said that they contacted the New York City police, and maybe he has a history of some nasty things in New York City. So New York City, he had record of him having this bitter hatred of women. What was happening? What I have is Thomas Burns was the chief detective there, so he was a famous guy at the time. And one time they asked Thomas Burns, not about Francis Tumbly, but they asked him when the Ripper murders were occurring and Scotland Yard was not successful at finding who this killer was, they asked Thomas Burns, what if the Ripper murders were occurring in New York City? Do you think you would catch him? He said, absolutely. You know, being quite an egotist himself, he says, well, what I would do is I would have a lot of these detectives in plain clothes or women's clothes and just filling the streets. As a matter of fact, one time there was a young man that was squirting acid on these women, and we caught him because he tried to squirt acid on one of the detectives. Surprise, surprise, I have a tall man in a gray ulster coat. Two different occasions, one in Boston, another one in New York City, where he's squirting acid on these young women and running away. So here's Thomas Burns. This is a third case saying that this man was squirting acid. He didn't name that man, but how Tumbly-like was that? If in this case, it would have been this San Francisco detective or chief detective saying something happened in New York City where Tumbly usually rested his hat. The other thing about Tumbly was that he was a transient. He always traveled by train. So he would spend a couple days in one spot. New York City, he'd spend a couple weeks. But every February, he'd be in New Orleans. But he would travel by train. So what I did was I plotted all of the 39 unsolved murders and the 39 assaults. And I put that on this map and plotted in Tumbly's annual train track pattern. So I figured out where he was going. And surprise, they match. And that was kind of scary. So they're matching.
What do you think was the cause of him being who he was? And why did he go to England, for instance? Like, what was the point there?
Well, the point for England was because when he was in, during the Civil War, after he got in trouble for, at the beginning when he tried to claim that he was working for the general as a surgeon, he booted out of Washington, D.C., but he came back as an Indian herb doctor, and he made boatloads of money. And so then he would go to St. Louis and do the same thing. And so then he would run around in a military outfit. But what happened was it was right when President Lincoln was murdered, and Tumbly was actually arrested on suspicion of being part of the murders because there was a claim that, John Wilkes Booth and David Harold, that Tumbly knew them, and in 1864, that David Harold actually worked for Tumbly in Brooklyn. Well, I know that's not true because I know who worked for him. Actually, the photograph of that guy looks very similar to David Harold. But what happened was it was apparently in Washington, D.C., a young man that was working for John Wilkes Booth claimed that David Harold had worked for Tumbly in Brooklyn. Well, he didn't. So even though Tumbly got arrested and spent 2 weeks in prison, he could easily prove that he was not that person. And so when that happened, though, they actually confiscated all of his money when he was in St. Louis. And he claimed it was $1 million of today's value that the army took. So, oh, by the way, in 1863, I found out that Tumbly was in Buffalo, New York. So was John Wilkes Booth, and Tumbly loved the theater, and I have a report that Tumbly was hanging out with John Wilkes Booth. So add that to it, but that's a later discussion. But what happened was is by 1873, even though everybody thought that Twombly went to London in 1869, and the only reason why that is because he wanted to be associated with a person that was still alive, that Charles Dickens, the author of that, so that he met him, but he didn't. The first time Twombly came back to London or England was 1873, and the reason was he claimed to be a British subject, and he wanted the British country, the British government, to help him get his money back. And that's why he was going back and forth at first. He had relatives. He had a sister still in Liverpool. And so then he actually started the business, the quack doctor business in Liverpool. And then a young man died of manslaughter there, and they blamed him, so he had to sneak out there. But so that's why he started going back and forth to London, but England. But he loved the city. And one of the things, I have countless eyewitness testimonies of Twombly each night would go into the streets at night, into the darkest areas. He'd always stay in the darkest part of the sidewalks where the streetwalkers were.
But what was his point to killing? Do you think that it was there a rush in the killing itself? Was he doing it for the body parts? Do you know what his thoughts were?
Yeah, based on the evidence, here's what I think. He's always had a lifetime bitter hatred, blaming these women for his condition. But I don't see that is what triggered him to start killing. I think what triggered him to start killing is when he caught syphilis. So it was around 1880 we realized he knew he had syphilis because he started going to Hot Springs, Arkansas, which was the Mecca for syphilis patients. And so they interviewed his doctor in Arkansas, in one of the Arkansas doctor, and they asked him, what do you think was wrong with Twombly? This was 1905. He said he had softening of the brain. Softening of the brain was a euphemism for paresis, paralysis of the insane, or neurosyphilis. And so that right there showed that it transgressed into neurosyphilis. So at first, I believe it was a rage killing, because just before a woman was murdered, a young lady was murdered in, you know, her name was Mary Cassidy, in August 1880 in Massachusetts along the train tracks. Twombly got on a train in Manhattan, go north, and that's one of the next train stops in Massachusetts. A woman, a young lady, was nearly decapitated and mutilated, and it's unsolved to this day. Well, surprise, surprise, 1 month before that, Twombly, we have record of him losing a court case to a woman. And because he blamed the woman's son, who was a teenager at the time, stole his money. And so they countersued him for molesting this young man. He lost the case. So this man, not only does he have syphilis, he's now enraged. And here is the very first unsolved murder, because this woman, there was no sign of rape, there was no sign of robbery, just a nearly decapitated on along the train tracks. So I think now, if you look at the female serial killer,
Elaine Warhouse?
Yes. If you notice, what she did is she first killed in January, and then there was a pause, and then she started killing, I think, maybe May, June, or something, and that was each month. So it was almost, you kill, oh boy, am I going to get in trouble? And so you kind of stop, and then you realize, I mean, a lot of these is that she had a taste for it. And so I think that was starting to happen. But also I think, especially right around 1886, what I find out is that he had this desire, this collection. So in January of 1888, he told we have a record of him telling a Toronto reporter that he was constantly in dread of sudden death because of kidney and heart disease. This is Twombly. Well, at the end of the 1888, these Whitechapel victims, one woman was missing the kidney, one woman and kidney and a uterus, another was missing a heart, and then a uterus. So those three organs that Jack the Ripper took, the kidney, the heart, and the uterus, can be connected to Twombly. Because Twombly had this passion. And uterus was actually where the fluids are for life begins. And so we have Scotland Yard. There was a case where a prominent engineer on the wealthy West End heard through the grapevine that this medical maniac, this doctor claiming to be a surgeon, prominent surgeon, was a medical maniac at night looking for the elixir of life, looking for fluids so that he would kill these women, wanted to extract the fluids from the uterus and mix them with herbs to create this elixir. Well, here's Tumbly was an innate herb doctor, and we have a record of him actually having an office near Whitechapel Road. So here we have him. And so here it is. He had his best friend, his boyfriend in the 1870s, was Sir Henry Hall Caine. Well, Hall Caine's best friend was Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, who was actually the business agent at the Lyceum Theater in 1888, just a week before the Ripper murders. Mansfield's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was being shown, being performed. And that's a person with a kind of an elixir. And then so at the Lyceum Theater, that the there was a new order of the workers started an order called the Order of the Golden Dawn, and their primary goal was to look for the Philosopher's Stone or the Elixir of Life. And so it's all these connections with this elixir. And here's Tumbledy being kind of right in the middle of that. So not so then in 1900, his Philadelphia attorney said that Tumbledy would be drinking this flask made of brown fluid all the time. So like an elixir. At beginning in the early 1880s, although he always had this passion for the organs because it showed, if you had these organs, it showed that you were a true surgeon, that here's maybe, you know, if indeed that he was the quack doctor that mutilated or dismembered this woman, Ella Clark, in 1881, that right there, and her organs were missing, maybe he was trying to, you know, do this at the time. But by 1886, his brain was going. Now, here's a man that claimed he could cure all disease. Now, he has a disease, and he couldn't cure himself. And so, clearly, I would see him looking for it. He was always going to hot springs and all these Saratoga springs, always these watering holes, because that was that actually in what they found out was that hot springs do actually improve if you have syphilis. It kind of elongates your health, your lifespan a bit. So it was pretty much helping him out. So here is a man claiming that there's, even in his autobiography, he claimed that there was this elixir of health out there that no one's found yet that can cure all things. And then that's in his autobiography. And then in 1893 autobiography, he finally admits there's no such thing as an elixir of life, or what he called eternal something, but it was an elixir. He admitted that. But before that, he never did. So here it is, Tumbledy, right around that time that he knew he had syphilis, these women that in London were being murdered, and it was almost there was another agenda. The agenda was to collect organs. And so here's a man that had a history of collecting organs, had a history of the especially the kidney, the heart, and the uterus. And it actually continues because Annie Chapman, she had her wedding ring and keeper ring stolen, two cheap brass rings. And then when Tumbledy died in 1903, on his personal possessions was as usual diamonds and gold, and there were two cheap brass rings.
The railway ripper. So what, the railway murders, there was no point to their murders? Like you're, and I'm saying reason wise, there was no, they weren't raped and they weren't robbed and stuff. So did you ever have an idea of why these people were killed?
Well, they have all the hallmarks of rage killing. The, you know, attack and mutilate the face or mutilate the neck. Well, for example, in St. Louis, there was actually a sex worker that was attacked. So she was walking and this tall man in a gray ulster coat comes and cuts her abdomen, and her kind of parts come out, and she starts dying. And so she's saying, this man attacked me. So they arrested a man, her ex-boyfriend, who they thought was, these onlookers thought it was him, and surprisingly, he was a tall man that had a gray jacket, but he had a solid alibi. And so the way she said stuff, realized that she didn't know her attacker, but she died. So it was this, just these, to me, it was just attack. There were a couple cases where we have, again, tall man in a gray ulster coat, how many times that in, across the river, there was a rash of attacks by a tall man in a gray ulster coat that were attacking women that were women were getting away, but there was one woman that didn't. And what happened was is she got clobbered over the head with a coupling in a metal thing. And they found her in a dark, empty lot. And so what happened was the next day, a minister came to the police and said, you need to talk to this young man. Well, what happened was this young man was actually in the morning of the murders. This was Paterson, New Jersey. But in the morning of the murders, he was actually in Yonkers, New York. And he was trying to get, you know, his ex-fiancée was getting married. And so he wanted to try it one more time. And it didn't work. So he was all bummed. So he got on, he was waiting for the train, 8 in the morning. He started drinking. And so he got on the train. He's traveling through Manhattan. And he noticed this tall man with a mustache and a gray Ulster coat was following him. And by the time he stopped at a bar, he thinks the guy slipped him a Mickey because he really got passed out. But he does remember him traveling on the ferry across the river to Paterson. And then what he remembered, and this is what he reported, that this tall man followed him outside when he walked off the train, grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and dragged him on the streets at night, just laid him against to a tree. Then he said that the man went up to this woman, knocked her out with something he had in his hand, and started dragging her into an empty lot. So that's when he ran away. So the police didn't believe him because they said he was drunk and that he could not have made it from Yonkers to Paterson in that amount of time. So I tried to see that, and he had ample amount of time because they thought that he was at that bar in Yonkers in the afternoon. But what I show that he was in that bar at 8 in the morning. He was there early. So he had ample time to be there. So here is a case where it was, to me, especially if it was Tumblety, it would be rage killing, you know, in the case that we have that.
Well, interesting case, lots of research. Now, the book is out now, of course, and it's called Dr. Francis Tumblety and the Railway Ripper. Now, the writer has been our guest, Mr. Michael L. Molly. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Al, and we'll see you next week when we interview Neil Story.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.